Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, indeedy, Buzzkillers. It's me, the old professor here. Today we're going to talk about the history of legal immigration to the United States. It seems as if immigration is a hot topic these days in the U.S., especially with talk of a border wall and other new restrictions. And I hope that buzzkillers from other countries will indulge us during this episode as we concentrate mainly on American history. But the fact that immigration is in the news constantly, and of course the fact that the topic as a whole involves countries and peoples around the world, should keep all buzzkillers interested. At least I hope so. In this episode, we're going to look at two of the biggest categories of myths and misconceptions about immigration to the United States. They are this vexing question of legal immigration and the history of government attempts to control immigration. But immigration is such a vast historical issue in American history, and there are so many people who have direct family history that relates to immigration, that we're going to have further episodes on other specifics about the history of immigration to the United States. So let me talk about legal immigration first before 1900. One of the biggest myths or misconceptions about the classic period of massive immigration to the United States, which is from the 1840s to the 1920s, is that all immigrants came here legally, or all immigrants that stayed anyway came here legally. You often hear this on talk radio shows when people call in to compare their immigrant ancestors who came here legally to some other immigrants who might come here illegally today. You see, the question of legal immigration is complicated by the fact that there were no major immigration laws until the late 19th century. Before 1875, there were no federal legal restrictions on immigration. Immigrants simply arrived at major ports on the coast, or they crossed the borders from Canada and Mexico. And even the laws passed between 1875 and the 1920s were usually targeted at immigrants from certain countries or those who had certain ethnic backgrounds. The main reason for the absence of restrictions on immigration was that the United States, especially the young United States, needed immigrants in the early decades of its history, especially with increasing industrialization. That's why it gets so fascinating after the 1840s. More workers were needed as factories and industries spread to regional cities and towns. And by regional cities and towns, I mean away from the East Coast. And although there's a great deal of anti-immigrant prejudice and hatred, which is going to be the subject of another episode, in the late 18th century and early 19th century, and throughout the 19th century, no laws were passed, again until 1875, to restrict the flow of immigrants into the country. Frankly, if our current immigration laws had been enforced between the 1880s and the 1920s, very few of those immigrants would have been allowed to enter the country legally. So let's look for a minute at government attempts to control immigration, because that government attempts to control immigration, frankly, are what end up defining what legal immigration meant. Here are the major laws passed on immigration before the 1920s. 1790, the Naturalization Act. Now, technically speaking, this isn't so much about immigration as it is about becoming a citizen. The 1790 Naturalization Act limited naturalized citizenship to free white immigrants of, and I'm quoting here, good character. But as I say, it didn't restrict immigration per se. Immigrants were not restricted, but citizenship was. But the question of new people coming into the country and new people becoming new Americans sort of stayed that way until, as I say, the late 19th century. Between 1790 and 1875, some individual states passed their own laws regarding immigration, but those laws and those regulations were not consistently enforced. Some states placed restrictions on immigrants from individual countries, or restrictions on people from specific religions, or even on other specific personal attributes, whether they were healthy or they had criminal backgrounds and things like that. But inconsistent laws, and certainly inconsistent applications of those laws, led to immigrants entering a port at a certain state in a certain state and then simply crossing the border to another state, crossing the state line over to New Jersey from New York. And that wouldn't have been considered immigration. You see, that's just moving from New York to New Jersey. And they do that later after immigrating from the big port. But as you know, buzzkillers, one of the hallmarks of the 19th century, particularly from the 1840s on to the 1880s, was the growth of industrialization. And with that, not only brought a lot of immigrant laborers, but moved a lot of the population more to the Midwest, away from the East Coast. Lots of the big cities in the Middle West and then the Far West were based around major rivers and could provide lots of power and, of course, transportation for these major industries. So the federal government decided that immigration was now a national issue by the late 19th century. Again, partly because a lot of immigrant laborers were working in industries, especially those like railroads, which were based in territories, which were not yet states, or which crossed state lines. So the old state laws about immigration were just proving to not only were they unworkable before, but they're certainly unworkable now that you had laborers moving across state lines almost on a daily basis. The first major act that the federal government passed about immigration was the Page Act in 1875. And the most important thing about the Page Act, at least for historians, is which group of immigrants it applied to. You see, the Page Act was also known as the Asian Exclusion Act. And frankly, buzzkillers, it sort of set the stage for restrictions based on racial or national origin. Importing Asian contract laborers was banned. Asian prostitutes or comfort women were also banned, as were any Asians who were criminals from their own countries of origin. Now, the important thing here is the idea of importing Asian contract laborers was banned. So it is technically not an immigration ban, but it effectively was because so many companies were importing Asians in large numbers on these contract bases. And only 7 years later, in 1882, the federal government passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was much more specific than the Page Act. And frankly, it was more enforceable. It's because people coming on ships from Chinese ports, identifiable Chinese ports, were not allowed to land. All Chinese laborers were banned from entry into the United States under this 1882 Act. And it was renewed twice during the next two decades, 1892 and 1902. Now, this doesn't mean, as you know, buzzkillers, things are complicated. Doesn't mean that no Chinese laborers came into the United States. Many did, but they did by coming into the U.S. by crossing over the Canadian and Mexican borders, right? They weren't coming into ports from China. But things started to get bigger and bigger and bigger in terms of immigration, and the federal government got further involved in 1891 when it passed an Immigration Act that set up an office within the Treasury Department, right, that made immigration controls more clearly a responsibility of Washington, D.C. The big historical theme here is that these early government attempts to control the influx of immigration were obviously based on race and national origin. Right? All these major acts were almost, they were all directed at Chinese laborers, not European laborers. Well, that starts to change a little bit, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it. Now, other congressional action in the early 20th century included a literacy requirement passed in 1917, which, by the way, meant literacy in your own native language. You weren't tested on English yet. And the Emergency Quota Act of 1921, which when it was combined a few years later with the Immigration Act of 1924, restricted immigration from Southern Europe and Russia. Now, immigration from Southern Europe and Russia had grown quite a lot in the early 20th century. And although we tend to think of the 20th century and immigration laws after the 1920s shifting away from questions of race and national origin and towards a system more like what we have now based on employment backgrounds and an individual's biological relationship to existing American citizens, it's a lot more complicated than that. And one of the things that really surprised me, buzzkillers, was how long the country went on passing laws that were based on race and were based on national origin. But I'll explain more about that after a word from our sponsors, Harry's Razors. Buzzkillers, I'm so happy that Harry's sponsors us because Harry's is all about history. For centuries, hundreds and hundreds of years, one or two razor companies, big razor companies, rip-off razor companies, have been charging you buzzkillers and your ancestors outrageous prices for razors. You know what they do? They make a small change in their blade. They come up with some new latest version, battery-powered or some different color, and they raise their already high prices. Well, our sponsors are better than that. They're more moral than that. They want you to have a great shave at a great price. Harry's is different than those rip-off razor companies. They don't believe in upcharging or just charging whatever they want because your grandfather and your great-grandfather and your his great-grandfather were ripped off by them. Harry's is making history. They've made their razors better and better, and the prices remain the same. Not only do they charge a fraction of what the rip-off razor companies charge, the buzzkillers at Harry's mail the razors right to you on a regular basis that you set up with your membership. You know why I love Harry's five-blade razors. They've got that soft flex hinge. The trimmer blade is fantastic. Abraham Lincoln used that to keep his beard nice and trim. Great lubricating strip. And a nice, fat, textured handle for more control. Again, the prices are $2 a blade compared to the $4 or more you'll pay at the drugstore. And don't even get me started on having to ask the village idiot to go open the lock case where the blades are and all that sort of crap. Harry's doesn't do this. Harry's owns the factory in Germany where they make these precision blades. They produce the highest quality razors themselves, sell them online, cut out the middleman, that's how they're able to give you prices that are half of what the rip-off razor companies charge. And they've got a special offer just for you buzzkillers out there. They'll send you their popular trial set for free when you go to harrys.com. That trial set includes the razor handle, the five-blade cartridge, and the shaving gel. Shaving gel is fantastic. You just pay a tiny amount, a percentage, $3 for the shipping. Given that it's a $15 or $20 value, it's great. Plus, just for my listeners, just for you buzzkillers, enter the code Buzzkill, B-U-Z-Z-K-I-L-L, at checkout, and Harry's will send you their post-shave balm for free with your order. Lady Buzzkill loves the post-shave balm. She insists that anytime we go out socializing, I go with a full Harry's program, the shave gel, the post-shave balm, on and on. You'll look better when you use it. Your face will feel better all day. Your subscription plan, of course, is customizable. We wouldn't allow any sponsor to do it anyway, any different. In terms of shipping frequency, and you can cancel at any time. Let me repeat that. Go to harrys.com, enter the code BUZZKILL at checkout. You get the great razor, the great blades, the shave cream, and the post-shave balm for free. Do it now. Start enjoying a whole new world of better and more affordable shaves. harrys.com, code at checkout is BUZZKILL. Now, back to the show. Okay, we're back from the sponsorship department. As I've been implying earlier, one of the many problems, both of the laws in the books in the 30s through the 50s, was not only that they were based partly on bigotry and racism, but they also had unintended consequences during and after World War II. By heavily restricting, for instance, immigration from Central Europe and Russia, the immigration laws of the 1920s and 30s made it difficult for refugees from war-torn and post-war Europe to come to the United States. This was particularly problematic because great numbers of Jews who'd survived the Holocaust were of Eastern European and Russian origin, and they wanted to come to the United States. And they also had a lot of political and moral support from American citizens on their side. Gradually, what happened, though, was that many of these displaced persons were allowed to come to the United States through various laws passed for wartime refugees. Technically, buzzkillers, the vast majority of these people were not immigrants, or at least not classified as immigrants by the government. They were refugees from a horrible situation, which is not only – and that being a refugee is not only a different category of migrant. It's another huge historical issue, which I hope, as I say, we'll get to in another show. And of course, there were other things. Additional laws were passed to deal with, for instance, women who'd married American servicemen during World War II. The War Brides Act of 1945 – cleared the way for ease of immigration for these wives. Now, if you're getting the impression, buzzkillers, that immigration laws in the United States historically were passed mainly in reaction to world events or reaction to beliefs based on hostility towards certain groups, rather than being based on carefully considered policies calmly arrived at. You're right. And unfortunately, the 1950s were not that different, although many people in federal government and many people in the chattering classes started to wonder whether this was the best way to go forward. Even so, laws were passed in 1952 reaffirming national origins quotas, and programs such as 1954's Operation Wetback. Yes, I said that. That was the name of it, Operation Wetback, which, as you can imagine, forced illegal immigrants from Mexico back over the border. Those were also put in place. Now, I don't have to tell you, Buzzkillers, one of the great criticisms of Operation Wetback was that government officials were not as careful as they should have been in determining who was an illegal Mexican immigrant. Often people of Mexican descent or people who looked Mexican were caught up in Operation Wetback and sent to Mexico. And, you know, ironically, that was illegal. Operation Wetback was actually breaking its own law, if you see what I mean. But starting in the 1960s, U.S. attitudes towards what immigration control should be started to change. The Korean War, the 1956 Hungarian Revolution, which brought up whole questions of refugees, the 1959 Cuban Revolution, which also brought up the question of refugees, and the effects of those events with regard to displaced persons were in everyone's recent memory at the time. If you think the post-war period, the 1950s, was all about Elvis and everybody, you know, starting up the baby boom, sorry. There are a lot of bad things going on and a lot of displaced people, a lot of political refugees. In other words, there are always going to be international problems which generated a great number of people who wanted to come to the United States or wanted to leave a very bad situation. And unless the federal government was going to keep trying to play catch up with whatever crisis had just erupted in a foreign country or region, in other words, pass the Korean War Refugees Act, pass the 1956 Hungarian Revolution Refugees Act, and on and on and on, something had to change. Now, interestingly, what happened was there was a gradual shift in attitude away from immigration controls based on national origin or race and toward immigration regulations and restrictions based on family relationships with U.S. citizens and permanent residents and on immigrants having certain highly needed and specific job skills. The first major law passed along these lines was the Hart-Celler Act, 1965. And further laws refining these new restrictions have been passed since the 1970s. Refugees, by the way, were granted admission to the United States under new legislation that allowed for their migration during times of crisis. And again, the more we dig into this issue, the more we realize we have a lot of other topics that come up with a lot of other – that bring up ideas for a lot of other shows. And we're not just being show busy about this, right? These are genuinely controversial and very deep historical problems. But that sort of brings me to the big point, the final point about the history of legal – and again, I'm putting legal in quotes – immigration. Now, of course, it's Buzzkill Institute policy that people should follow the law. But we must be careful when looking back over a couple hundred years of government immigration policies and law. Although the vast majority of immigrants who settled in the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries were legal and immigrated legally, immigration laws and restrictions changed so drastically and so often that it's impossible for us to say that there have been long-standing attitudes in American history about who should be allowed into the country legally. Generally speaking, unless you were from Northwestern Europe and white, the chances of you coming into the United States as a legal immigrant were mainly based on whether you were fortunate enough to travel during a relatively mild period, that is, so I shouldn't say relatively mild period, relatively open period, that is before the 1880s, or whether you were able to come in under the upper limit of a numerical national slash ethnic slash racial quota. And those things, again, ran for almost 100 years, 1880 to 1965. Difficult, difficult, difficult to do. Even difficult to know whether you're going to be legal, whether you're doing the right thing, whether you're doing the legal thing. As with so many other historical issues that sweep across decades and centuries, legal immigration is as complicated a concept as there can be. Easy generalizations about history never get through the front door at the Buzzkill Institute, and the twisted and convoluted historical question of legal immigration is one of the best examples of why that's so. Talk to you next week.